All right, welcome in everyone to the deep dive. We're diving into a super important case today from the South Carolina Supreme Court, Connor v. City of Forest Acres, decided back in 2002. And this one, well, it's like the cornerstone for figuring out when those employee handbooks, you know, the ones they hand you on day one, actually have some legal teeth, even in states like South Carolina, where at will, employment is the norm.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And for those of you out there wrestling with employment law in law school, paying close attention to Connor, that's going to be a game changer for you. What we're going to really unpack here is how those everyday policies and employee handbooks can actually give employees, yeah, you, more contractual rights than you might think, considering that at-will default. Yeah. It's like where HR meets contract law.
Totally. And we know you all are busy, right? You want the info fast. You want it clear. So consider this your express lane to understanding a landmark case. Our mission's pretty straightforward today. We're going to break down that central legal clash between the typical at-will employment world and the promises, sometimes super obvious, sometimes hidden, that are tucked away in those handbooks. And our prime example, our case study, if you will, is Connor v. City of Forest Acres.
To make sure we're giving you the full picture, we've actually looked at this from several different perspectives. We've got some really detailed guidance that kind of walks us through the back and forth of the case. Then there's this perplexity analysis, gets into all the nitty-gritty legal stuff. And of course, we've got a standard case brief that lays out all the essentials. Each one gives us a unique angle on Connor, different, but all equally valuable.
Okay, so let's get started. First things first, the backstory. The real-life drama that unfolded before all the legal arguments. The main character here is Evelyn Connor. She worked as a police dispatcher for the City of Forest Acres for 9 years, a good chunk of time. And for most of that time, her work history was pretty standard until we get to her last year there.
You know, what's really interesting when you're digging into a case like this is looking at how everything played out step by step in that final year. So beginning in November 1992, Connor starts getting a bunch of reprimands. It wasn't just one big thing. It was like a whole collection of issues. Dress code violations, showing up late, questions about how well she was doing her job. Even one time she left work without permission. And then there were accusations of her using, well, abusive language. All of this, it really sets the scene for the legal showdown that's about to come.
It really does seem like things were going downhill fast between Connor and her employer. And then things really came to a head in July 1993. Connor got a performance evaluation that was basically a big, fat, unsatisfactory. Right after that, boom, 90-day probation. But the problems didn't stop there. August rolls around, same year, she gets hit with two more reprimands. And then in October, another evaluation. Things had improved a little, but not enough. So finally, October 7, 1993, that's the day she was fired.
But as you'll learn, getting fired is often not the end of the story, is it? Connor, she wasn't giving up that easy. She filed a grievance, went right after those reprimands she'd been given. Now, here's the kicker. The grievance committee, the folks reviewing her case, they actually voted 2-1 to recommend that she gets her job back. Reinstatement, they called it.
Wow, so that's a pretty strong message to send, right? You'd think the city would take a reinstatement recommendation from their own grievance committee seriously. But in this case, the city council, they stepped in and basically said, nope. They decided to reject the recommendation, went ahead and backed up the termination. So, Connor, facing that, she decided to take the fight to court. She claimed her firing was wrongful.
And a big part of her argument, and this is what makes this case so important for all you future lawyers, is that during her 9 years at the City of Forest Acres, they didn't just have one employee handbook. They had two different ones. And here's the really crucial part, Connor. She had signed acknowledgement forms for both of them. And this is where the legal analysis gets interesting. That second handbook, the one from 1993, the one that was active when she got fired, it had this disclaimer, an at-will disclaimer. Basically, it said that all the stuff written in the handbook, it didn't create an actual employment contract between Connor and the city.
So you can see where this is going, right? The big legal puzzle, where in South Carolina, a state that's all about at-will employment. Just a quick refresher for anyone who needs it. At-will employment, that means the employer, they can fire you for any reason or no reason at all, as long as it's not because of illegal discrimination or something like that.
Exactly. So the million-dollar question in Connor's case is, can that basic at-will rule be changed? Connor, she's saying, hold on, that employee handbook, even with the disclaimer, it created some promises the city had to keep. She's arguing that when they fired her, they broke those promises. They breached a contract.
It really shows you the kind of tug of war that can happen in these situations, right? Employers, they want to keep things flexible with that at-will setup, but then they hand out these handbooks. And those handbooks often have really specific procedures, especially when it comes to discipline. Kind of makes you think of what some legal folks call a schizophrenic handbook, right? One section's like, we can fire you anytime, no reason needed. And then another section's like, here's this super detailed step-by-step discipline process we're going to follow every single time.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. That's the conflict at the heart of so many of these cases. And in Connor v. City of Forest Acres, the South Carolina Supreme Court, they really had to grapple with this exact issue. What's important for you to understand is the court said you can't just look at one little piece of the handbook, like that disclaimer, and ignore everything else. They stressed that you got to look at the totality of the handbook, the whole thing.
So let's dig a little deeper into how the court thought about contracts being formed in the context of these handbooks. It seems like they put a lot of emphasis on the specific words used in those sections about employee discipline.
They definitely did. The court zeroed in on what they call mandatory language, often using words like shall and will. So, for instance, imagine a handbook says certain violations will result in specific disciplinary actions. Or maybe it outlines this whole progressive discipline process that shall be followed in all cases. The court said that kind of language, that's not just a suggestion. It creates real expectations for employees. It means the employer is obligated to follow those procedures.
So it's not just like friendly advice. It's like a real promise they have to keep. And from Connor, it seems like we can almost extract a three-part test, like a checklist the court uses to decide if an employee handbook, the whole thing, actually creates a contract, one that overrides that basic at-will status.
I think that's a really useful way to think about it. So the first part of the test is all about how specific are the procedures in the handbook. The more details, the more specific they are about things like how discipline works, what can get you fired, the grievance process, the more likely the court is to say, yep, that's a contract. It makes sense, right? If it's all vague, nobody really knows what to expect.
Right. The more concrete the promise, the more likely they'll be held to it. What's the next thing on the court's checklist?
The second part is about how obvious are the disclaimers. So even if you've got this clear at-will disclaimer saying, hey, this ain't a contract, the court's going to look at how easy is it to find that disclaimer? Is it buried in tiny print on page 99? Or is it super clear and upfront, maybe even on a separate page that the employee has to sign? A disclaimer that's hidden or hard to understand is not going to be as effective. The idea is employees need to know, without a doubt, that they're not being offered a contract, you know, something that changes their at-will status.
So you can't just sneak the disclaimer in there and expect it to work. It's got to be right out in the open. All right, last piece of the puzzle. What's the third part of this test?
This one's kind of the big picture view. It's about how a reasonable employee would interpret the whole handbook. So the court will put themselves in the employee's shoes. You're reading this handbook. You understand your job. What would you think? Would you think those disciplinary procedures, all those policies, are just suggestions the employer can ignore whenever they feel like it? Or would you think, hey, my boss actually has to follow these rules? This part of the test makes sure the court's thinking about the handbook from the employee's perspective.
That's a good way to tie everything together. The court isn't just looking at specific words. They're thinking about the whole document and what it means in the real world for the employee and employer. And there's this really powerful statement from the court in the Connor decision that gets right to the heart of this.
Oh, yeah. There's this key quote where the court said, "It's patently unjust to let an employer write a handbook with all these mandatory terms, and then let him ignore those policies whenever it benefits him." That really sums up their thinking. They're not letting employers play both sides, saying one thing to employees but doing another when it's convenient.
I see what you mean. So let's say a court decides, yep, this handbook, it's a contract, it changes the at-will situation. The next big question is, did the employer actually break that contract? And it's important to remember, the standard for breaking a contract in these situations, it's not about proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that Evelyn Connor was completely innocent.
That's a really important detail for you all to grasp. The South Carolina Supreme Court, in Connor, they made it clear the big question isn't whether the employee was actually guilty of whatever they're accused of. The standard is, did the employer honestly believe? Did they have a good reason to fire the employee when they made that decision?
So, even if Connor did mess up sometimes, if the city of Forest Acres made up other reasons to fire her, or if they were sneaky and ignored the grievance committee's recommendation without A good reason, well, that could be a breach of contract, right? A breach of that handbook contract.
Exactly. Let's imagine for a second. Let's say in Connor's case, the city blew some of those reprimands way out of proportion, or maybe even made some of those performance issues up entirely, just to make it seem like firing her was justified. Even if there were some legit issues, even small ones, making up extra reasons, well, that suggests that the city maybe didn't actually believe they had a good reason to fire her, not according to their own handbook policies.
Now, there's this other really interesting aspect of the Connor case, something people often overlook. It's the potential for what's called fraudulent breach of contract. South Carolina law, it sees that as a whole different kind of claim, right?
Yeah, it does. It takes things a step further than just a regular breach of contract. Hmm. A fraudulent breach, that means the breach happened because the other party, in this case, the employer, did something dishonest. The Supreme Court in Connor, they specifically talked about how this kind of claim could come up in this situation.
So how did they define what a fraudulent act is, specifically when it comes to firing someone?
They said it's basically dishonesty or unfair dealing when you fire an employee. This means you have to show more than just the employer not following the handbook. You have to show they were intentionally deceitful, acted in bad faith, or were just so incredibly unfair in how they fired the person.
And you can see how this connects to what Connor was claiming, right? She was basically saying, the city made up reasons to fire me. They didn't tell the truth.
Exactly. If Connor could prove to a jury that the city didn't really believe she deserved to be fired, not based on their own rules, and that they instead cooked up reasons to justify it, well, that could be enough to prove a fraudulent act. And that could mean a whole different level of liability for the city.
It seems like the fact that the grievance committee actually recommended her reinstatement, even though the city council ignored it, and the timing of all those reprimands all piling up in her last year, those could be seen as evidence to back up her claim, right? Evidence that the city's reasons weren't the real reasons.
Absolutely. Those facts, they could definitely be used to argue that the city wasn't being truthful about why they fired Connor, or that they were being unfair in a way that goes beyond just not following the handbook. And the court itself, when talking about fraudulent breach, they said, fraud, in this sense, assumes so many hues and forms. This means deciding if a fraudulent act happened, it really depends on the specific facts of the case. Each one's unique.
So, big picture, looking back at everything we've talked about with Connor v. City of Forest Acres, what are the biggest takeaways for you all, especially those of you getting ready to be lawyers, just starting out?
If you're thinking about representing employers, this case is like a giant flashing warning sign. You got to be so careful about inconsistent or confusing language in those handbooks. If you put in strong at-will disclaimers, but then give very specific mandatory procedures, especially about discipline and firing, you're basically inviting employees to argue that a contract was formed and broken. So pay attention to every detail. Make sure the whole handbook is consistent. That's how you protect your clients.
And what about those of you who might end up representing employees in these kinds of disputes?
For you, Connor shows how important it is to document every single time an employer seems to break their own rules, the rules in their handbook. If they're not following their own policies, that's gold. That's evidence you can use in a breach of contract claim. You want to carefully compare what the handbook says to what the employer actually did.
And some advice for everyone, no matter who you end up representing.
This case really hammers home that when you're dealing with an employee handbook in a contract dispute, you can't just focus on one little part. You can't cherry pick a disclaimer or a procedure. You got to look at the whole thing. Every word, how a normal employee in that situation would understand it, all of it matters.
And it seems like Connor also shows us that when there's real debate about how to interpret the handbook and whether the employer acted in good faith, it's really hard for a court to just dismiss the case early on. These are often factual questions that need a full trial, a jury, or a judge to decide.
Absolutely right. In the Connor decision itself, the Supreme Court, they said there were real questions about the facts of the case, how to interpret the handbooks, what the city did. That's exactly why they overturned the lower court's decision and said this case needs a full trial.
So, to wrap things up, Connor v. City of Forest Acres, it's a huge reminder that employee handbooks, they're not just some formality. They're not just paperwork you sign and forget about. Depending on what they say and the whole situation surrounding them, they can be legally binding, even in at-will states like South Carolina.
That's the key takeaway, folks, and it really gets you thinking. How do these legal rules from this 2002 case, how do they play out in the workplace today?
Things are changing so fast, right? Companies are using websites and apps for their policies, digital handbooks, everything's online. So what happens then? When do a company's online statements, their digital policies, become real contracts? That's something to really keep in mind as the way we work keeps changing in this digital age.
Absolutely something to ponder. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Econavie City of Forest Acres.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Until next time, keep diving deep, everyone.